Okay, I guess we have one more that just joined.
Alex Turner from Harvard.
Hey. Well, why don't we get started? I'll probably just turn it over to Arlen and just mention that at the end we could take a few minutes to talk about the science team meeting for anyone who's interested and going to be at the meeting to talk a little bit about what we want to do during the time we have allocated for the working group. But otherwise, I'll let Arlen present. So thanks again, Arlen, for telling us about your projects. I hope everyone got the slides. Let me know. If not, then I can email those out.
See, I put that completely wrong date on the title slide. I think it's 2010, apparently. And should have listed all my CMS co-investigators on the title slide. They are Thomas Nearcorn and Mary Kate Mountain from AER, John Miller, who's here at the University of Colorado, and NOAA, Anna Michalak from Carnegie Institution of Washington and Stanford, and Chris O'Dell from Colorado State. And then in my 2012 CMS project, we also had Elena Novikovskaya from Earth Networks, but she's no longer there, and we've gone a little bit of a different direction with the second project. Thank you, Heather, for allowing me to tell you about our efforts to develop Lagrangian modeling tools for carbon cycle science in general, but also specifically here for the carbon monitoring system. So I have an outline on slide two. I'll talk a little bit about why we at NOAA have been wanting to develop a Lagrangian modeling tool, then provide an overview of the work that we're doing, some details about the mechanics of the Carbon Tracker Lagrange inversion framework, and a smattering of preliminary results both from inverse simulations and forward modeling, and our plans for the new CMS project that was just selected. Okay, motivation on the next several slides starting at slide four. I've just picked out a couple examples of recent papers that have used Lagrangian frameworks for regional estimation of both methane and CO2. So Scott Miller had a paper that got a lot of attention in PNAS looking at methane emissions using mainly data from our lab, NOAA's Global Monitoring Division, and also some aircraft campaign data from the Harvard Group, and from a few others like the DOE folks at the Southern Great Plains ARM site. So also Andrew Hsu and Thomas Laveau, Tasha Miles, Scott Richardson from the Penn State Group, had a study looking at top-down versus bottom-up methods in the mid-continent. This was the mid-continent intensive synthesis project that was part of the NACP. So the idea was to look at the agricultural regions where we have a lot of data about the crop yields and such, and see if we could, in this sort of not complex terrain area, sort of flat, and then highly instrumented for this time period region, see if we could reconcile the top-down and bottom-up. And it actually turned out pretty well in the study that Andrew presented in Global Change Biology. And then Thomas Laveau had a nice paper looking at some of the uncertainties in the atmospheric inversion in the context of the mid-continent intensive. Sung-Yoon Yang, who works with Mark Fisher, and others had a nice have come a long way in their top-down methane estimates at the state scale for California, with a lot of support from the California Air Resources Board and other entities. And so Carbon Tracker Lagrange is an effort to kind of institutionalize some of these methods. And NOAA, being NOAA, we have the sort of long-term mission and the infrastructure that enables us to kind of take all these studies, each of which has been done slightly differently, you know, different mathematical constructs, like some people solve for a daytime and a nighttime CO2 correction, some people solve for scalar, diurnal cycles. There's a lot of different ways to set up the calculation. And so when you're looking at different studies and trying to compare them, sometimes you don't really have an apples-to-apples comparison. And so one of our objectives is to try to do some multi-year studies and some systematic comparisons with different mathematical constructs, different priors, different prior error covariance models, different model data mismatch models, different sets of observations, different weighting, you know, all kinds of different sort of flavors of these calculations. And so another motivating factor has been the emergence of a really quite dense in situ monitoring network over North America, and also a lot of other kinds of data, remote sensing data that has been validated more carefully for the North American continent. So under the auspices of the North American Carbon Program, a lot of really great data has been collected. So it's an effort. Carbon Tracker Lagrange is an effort to try to use that data most effectively in order to constrain the carbon fluxes. And so on slide 9, I have a map of surface monitoring sites, kind of showing how things changed between 2008 and 2012, how they might change in the future with some of those open triangles that are from the Earth Networks Lab that are planned sites. Penn State is also in the process of deploying a ring of towers, temporary tower installation in the southeast. And then we have some NOAA aircraft sites that are the red triangles. And so in the summer of 2012, there were about 50 sites, which is a huge improvement over 1992 when there was one, and 2004 when there were about 3 continuous sites. Britt Stevens has a network of sites in the Rocky Mountains, Bev Law in Oregon. There are a lot of towers coming online in California that many of which aren't on this map, which I made several years ago. But the point is there's a lot of data available. And in 2014, the list that I have now includes more than 100 sites. And some of them are going to be harder to model than others. That list includes temporary installations that are meant to be temporary, like in the Indianapolis influx experiment and other things. But still, you can see it's quite a lot of data. And one thing that we haven't been able to do, mainly due to a shortage of resources, is really careful intercomparison across these sites to ensure comparability across the networks. A lot of them are using standard gases from our lab, but we could definitely be doing a lot more to ensure compatibility at the continental. Environment Canada has had a huge expansion, and I think that's going to be really helpful for looking at Arctic carbon. I don't want to spend any more time on this slide, but if we go to the next slide, which is slide 10, I have a residuals plot from NOAA's Eulerian Carbon Tracker, which is the official carbon tracker modeling system. And a recurring feature of Carbon Tracker is that it has an excess of CO2 in the summer over North America compared to the observations. And it's a little bit hard to see on this plot, and I did not have time to make a better one, but you can see that every year in the summer, there are many, many residuals that are more than 5 ppm, you know, certainly a lot between 1 and 5 ppm, and many observations that are rejected completely because the model is so far off that it's more than 3 times the model data mismatch. So there's a lot of red points in July that are in excess of even 10 ppm. So if you do the statistics, if you look at the mean bias or the median bias in July, it can be as much as 3 ppm, which is just huge in terms of the net annual uptake for CO2. So I am hopeful that Lagrangian methods can potentially enable more effective use of the data than we have been able to achieve so far in the Eulerian carbon tracker. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, Arlen, this is Ralph. This is kind of a dumb question, but what's the difference between residual and model data mismatch?
Oh, okay, so model data mismatch is the expected level of agreement between the optimized CO2 and the observations. So it's like the way it's set up in Carbon Tracker is it's a single number. It's something like 3.5 ppm. So the model is expected to be able to achieve agreement at that level. And then if we have an observation that the prediction of Carbon Tracker is so far off, it doesn't even get it just rejects the observation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe we shouldn't dwell on it. I guess my only question then would be, why is the orange got so much structure?
You know what? I think I misspoke. I think there is folded into the – so these plots used to be really simple, but recently Andy Jacobson has started running Carbon Tracker in kind of an ensemble mode, and the model data mismatch may include some aspect of transport uncertainty or uncertainty across the ensemble members.
Yeah, we don't need to dwell on it. I think that's enough, Arlen. Why don't you go
yeah.
on?
Yeah, sorry. I don't know exactly why it has so much structure. It used to just be a single number. And there's definitely that single number that's 3.5 in there somewhere, but then somehow some transport uncertainty gets folded in. And I will ask Andy.
Arlen, are you talking about, this is John, are you talking about the LEF plot?
Yeah, on slide 10.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Model data mismatch have so much structure. I don't remember.
It does include a projected transport uncertainty as well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't want to get bogged down into how
Ralph, you can contact me
so
if you want.
So I'm going to go on to slide 12. So now we're talking about sort of an overview of the Carbon Tracker Lagrange project, both for CMS but also more generally. So this Carbon Tracker Lagrange effort we have a lot of partners, and on one of the next slides I have attempted to list all of them. And like I already said, we're trying to take full advantage of the measurements and data sets that have been developed under the North American Carbon Program, not just atmospheric data, but also better priors and other kinds of data sets that might be out there to help inform our understanding, to help us get to an actual sort of mechanistic understanding and not just carbon accounting. We have been supported by NOAA's Climate Program Office through the Atmospheric Chemistry Carbon Cycle and Climate Program, and then the NASA Carbon Monitoring System funding has enabled us to broaden the activity to include satellite data and TCON data. The core of the effort is the high-resolution WRF-STILT atmospheric transport model that has been customized for Lagrangian modeling by Thomas Nerkorn and the folks at AER. Mary Kate has run millions and millions of Stilt-WRF footprints, and we're also testing some more operational products using the NOAA high-split model, which is closely related to Stilt. It lacks a few features that Stilt lacks, but high-split has been upgraded recently so that it can compute footprints. And we use the North American model archived MET files, which are at 12-kilometer resolution or 32 kilometers resolution if you go further back in time. High-split the HRRR model, H-R-R-R, is a new 3-kilometer simulation, and when I copied this bullet from a previous slide. HRRR is actually now operational at NSEP. Previously, it was run in a demonstration mode here at NOAA Israel in Boulder. But so there's this new 3-kilometer model out there, and if we can show that those footprints, that we can produce reliable footprints from those, that's actually, you know, it's approaching a cloud-resolving model, and the domain is all of CONUS. So that's a pretty promising product. And then a big advantage of Carbon Tracker Lagrange is that because we do all the heavy lifting at the beginning when we compute the library of footprints, we then can do many, many variants of the inversion at relatively low computational cost. And so we can test aspects of the setup, like some of the examples that I went through, different priors, different mathematical constructs. Are we saving for are we solving for multiplicative factors, like an Eulerian carbon tracker? Are we solving for additive corrections, like some of these other Lagrangian studies have done? We can do geostatistical inversions, and that's something that we're definitely hoping to do more of over the next few years under the CMS project. So slide 13 is an attempt to list the team. I said most of these people already, but through a collaboration with Harvard, Besh Ben-Murghi and Scott Miller are continuing to do methane inversions, and they're now coding in our framework. So one thing that I would really like to achieve with this project is to work with partners and, you know, provide access to our code and work with different university partners to code in our Python framework so that we can incorporate new modules, and we're going to make all of this code freely available once we get it out of the alpha mode and into a beta mode. We're getting close to that. So hopefully we'll have additional partners as we move forward. And then in addition to that, there are a whole lot of data providers, and obviously having the data is crucial for doing inverse modeling. So the slide 14 lists some of our core products that we're aiming towards. So number one is we've worked with the data providers to build a new Carbon Tracker Lagrange OBS pack. We have to do a few revisions. A couple data sets weren't available when we made the prototype version, but this is a NetCDF. I have a little bit of info about OBS pack on the next slide, but it's a NetCDF data package which I'll get into more detail in the next slide. And then we also have the WRF simulations that reside on the NASA supercomputer Pleiades that AER has done. So we could go back and use them for different footprints or to run a different particle model or for other applications. And so these have to go all the way back to 2004, but the domain and some of those runs were done under an earlier Anna Mikulec NASA project, and some of you might have seen footprints from that work. We can go all the way back to 2004. The model improves as we go forward in time. Carbon Tracker Lagrange is focusing on 2007 to 2010 initially because the network was fairly stable. The WRF simulations are all pretty compatible from 2007 onward. Prior to 2007, we didn't have any sites in the Southeast U.S., and so I think the low-hanging fruit is from 2007 forward. And then starting in 2009, we have GOSAT data. So the CMS activities focus on 2009 forward. And then John Miller is getting some BRAMS runs from Amazonia that were funded under his previous CMS project. And we're going to that's mostly 2010 and 2011, and we're going to update that to include 2015. So then we have a footprint library with more than 1 million receptors, and I'll go into more detail about that. And it is my stated intention to get those footprints up on an FTP server before at least the ones for the project that just finished, to get them up before the CMS meeting in November. And we do have sample footprints available that you can download now. And then as we begin doing inversions, additional products will be the optimized fluxes, an optimized 4D boundary value field, which is basically a correction to the carbon tracker mole fraction fields, which have some well-known biases. And then we'll have posterior simulated CO2 corresponding to the observations, meaning we will have optimized CO2 profiles corresponding to the GOSAT scenes and eventually the OCO2 scenes that are optimally consistent with the in-situ data, so that we can use the carbon tracker framework to try to investigate to what extent the data set seems to be consistent. So slide 15 is just a screenshot of a reference of a paper from Ken Masseri that describes OBSTOC, which is a new framework that he's developed to try to deliver greenhouse gas data to the community with all of the metadata that we need, including some flagging, such as like at a site like Scripps Pier, where the data might sometimes be clean marine air and other times be polluted, or a site like Barrow, where sometimes the flow is off the ocean and sometimes it's off the continent. You can have information like a representativity flag. You can have uncertainty information. Whatever is provided by the data provider can be passed through. And then importantly, it also has a lot of comprehensive data attribution. Like, who do you acknowledge? How should you acknowledge? Who do you contact? And any partners that are involved in your site who might not be full-fledged data providers, but people who really need to be acknowledged for the data set. So I think this is a really important development, and I hope it starts to gain wide use. And this is how we intend to distribute data that is used in Carbon Tracker Lagrange. And most of the providers are really happy to provide their data in this way so far, at least the older data. So the WRF simulations are sort of described on slide 16. It's a nested domain with 30-kilometer resolution in the outer domain and 10 kilometers in the inner domain that covers all of CONUS. The red box shows the region for which we produce a gridded footprint. So you can see that there, because of the shape of the MET domain, the MET model is run on an equal area grid, whereas the footprints are done in rectangular lat lawn grids. And so, you know, like Hawaii is in our footprint grid, but we will never have any sensitivity because it's outside of our MET model domain. And that's just something you kind of have to know when you're using these footprints, which are really designed to look at the continent. And another comment. So this domain has been constant since about 2008. Earlier runs were done with 40-kilometer resolution in the outside. And we do allow the WRF simulations to improve with time. So if a new version of WRF comes out, we change. So it's not that we have a fully consistent set of MET fields from 2004 to 2010. We've opted instead to do kind of best available. So does anybody have any questions before I describe the silt footprints? Okay. So we have the STILT model is a particle model, particle dispersion model. We typically run with 500 particles, which is much fewer than is done with something like FlexPart, where they often run tens of thousands. We try to compensate for that by far field smoothing, and you know, really the results don't look all that different between FlexPart and STILT, so I think it works pretty well. We do 10-day back trajectories that we then use to compute footprints. And we have three footprints in our Carbon Tracker Lagrange NetCDF files. One is 1 by 1 degree with hourly resolution. That's really just for convenience and compatibility with NOAA's Carbon Tracker. We added a second footprint for compatibility with the NASA CMS Flex products and GeoSCAM and other kind of MARA-driven or Goddard wind-driven products. So those have 1 degree latitude by 1.25 degree longitude resolution and hourly. And then we also have a near-field footprint, and I'll show you an example of what that looks like, where just for the first 24 hours, we compute the footprint at a tenth of a degree by a tenth of a degree for a subdomain that is centered on the receptor location. We also archive the trajectories for the particles. And that's useful if you want to do something like do an inversion on a small subdomain like California. You can compute your own domain endpoints from the trajectory information that we save. And we do a bunch of forward simulations, which is essentially convolving the footprint with a flux model. So we have convolutions with the Carbon Tracker and Goddard, CASA GFED 3 fluxes. So we have the component fluxes. So we have the part of the delta CO2 over the last 10 days that can be attributed to fossil fuels or biological. In the case of CASA, we can separate photosynthesis and respiration. We have fire and ocean, which is typically really small for these continental footprints. And then all the products are archived in a single net CDF file that is climate forecast compliant, which is meaningful to some people. And it's the new version of NetCDF, version 4 or something later, that includes compression. So the actual data files, the data volume is manageable. So we have, like, about 1 million footprints. Mary-Kate might know the exact number. And the whole thing is around, it depends exactly what you want, but it's of order a few terabytes. Like, you can manage it. It's not exabytes, which it would be if we hadn't done a lot of work to sort of thin the files. So there's a picture of a footprint there. It's on a log scale. Sometimes people complain about the log scale, but if you look at how the sensitivity drops off as you go back in time, you see that the far field is actually really important because the area is so big. So it's a weak influence, but over a large area, which actually is comparable in magnitude to the very near field. So sometimes people prefer to plot these on a linear scale, but I actually think the log scale is a helpful way to look at it. On slide 18, I have an example of the near field footprint. So that's the big plot on the left. And you can compare that to the upper right, where it's the first 24 hours from the 1 degree footprint. So you can see how much more detail we have in the near field footprint. And then just for context, on the lower right, I repeated the full 10-day footprint. Does anybody have any questions before I move on? Okay, so the footprint library mainly has been populated so far for 2007 to 2010. We're working with AER to try to add 2011 and 2012. And Environment Canada has actually gotten involved, and they're trying to help us extend this record all the way to present. The new CMS project is focused on 2015 in order to coincide with the first year of OCO2 data, so we need to use NOAA resources to fill in that gap and other resources. So for surface and tower sites with continuous data, we did 8 footprints per day in order to resolve the diurnal cycle. And they're done, not every site is done at the same UTC hour. Each site is synced to 2 p.m. solar time so that we get a middle of the afternoon observation and then every 3 hours thereafter. Then the surface and aircraft loss samples from NOAA's Global Greenhouse Gas Reference Network are also included. We have done the TCON sites that are in our domain, which unfortunately doesn't go far enough north to get Eureka. So we have basically JPL, Park Falls, and Lamont, and we can do the influx and Dryden as we go forward into the present. So we, based on some conversations with Deborah Wunsch, we decided to do 2 simulations per day, one corresponding to solar noon, and the other corresponding to the time of day when the solar zenith angle is 70 degrees. So that allows us to basically, if there are any solar zenith angle dependent artifacts in the carbon tracker data, you can use, in the TCON data, you would be able to minimize that by using observations from that same time of day. And the choice of 70 degrees was a compromise between with the sun, having the sun as high as possible in the sky, but also covering the maximum range of latitudes and seasons. So that latitude corresponds to, I want to say it's like the minimum solar zenith angle, like the solar zenith angle on the winter solstice. The highest the sun is in the sky on the winter solstice in Park Falls, Wisconsin, I believe is how I came up with that 70 degree thing. And then we've also done the GOSET simulations. And so those are only so far for 2009 and 2010, and it only is for scenes that pass the ACOS cloud screening and quality control, which is not a huge number of observations, as you'll see if I manage to get through this, and you can see some of the results where I have the number of simulations. And then every column observation, so GOSET and TCON, is actually simulated as a profile of footprints. So we store the footprint profile with so that you can look at the individual altitudes separately, and you can change the way you weight them according to the algorithm, according to the averaging kernel. So if somebody comes up with a different TCON retrieval that has a different averaging kernel, you'll be able to deal with that. And then we're doing something called the Summer 2012 Network Design Case Study, which is really we've added a bunch of non-existent surface network sites, additional TCON sites, some synthetic satellite data. I plan to add an augmented aircraft network, but we haven't run those yet. And then we'll focus on transport model comparisons on summer 2012. That was sort of where the Earth Networks data came in, because they added like something like 14 or 15 new sites in 2012 compared to the network we had in 2010. So we wanted to look at the impact of that new data. So the inverse model framework itself is based on the Yadav and Mikulak paper that came out in 2013. It's very efficient, and so it allows you to run the inversions pretty quickly. We just run it right now on a regular old Linux computer, not even a supercomputer, and we can do like a 3-month inversion with boundary value optimization in a couple of hours. Depending on what part of the framework you want to vary, you can do some calculations as quickly as like 20 minutes, but if you need to rebuild the prior error covariance matrix and there's this HQHT term, that's expensive building that, so that's what drives the time. So it's coded in Python. We recoded the algorithms that we got from Vineet, which were in Fortran. We recoded them in Python. We have implemented boundary value optimization, which is really important for our regional inversions, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And we're focusing here at NOAA, we're focusing on continental scale inversions, but you could apply the framework to more local scales, you know, oil fields or urban areas. There's nothing about this framework that doesn't translate to higher resolution. So I'm going to kind of skip over this boundary inflow stuff or gloss over it, but a problem in Carbon Tracker, Eulerian Carbon Tracker, is that it has the inflow to North America wrong, or at least this has been true until very recently, and I think it's still true even in the 2013 version of Carbon Tracker. So if you look at Cold Bay, Alaska, for example, you can see that there are high residuals in the summer. I zoomed in on a particular year, but this happens year after year after year. It's several ppm high, and I would argue that the Carbon Tracker is precluded from getting the right fluxes in North America because it has the wrong inflow coming from Eurasia. And so you can't get the right flux if you have the wrong boundary value. Then on slide 22, this vertical profile plot got rotated when it was converted to a PDF. But it shows, if you can turn your head sideways, that in the summer, this excess of CO2 that I showed you at LEF and just now at Cold Bay is actually persistent throughout the troposphere at the sort of boreal latitudes, 45 to 70 degrees, and it's mainly confined to the boundary layer at the lower latitudes, but it's a pretty significant enhancement in the model compared to the observations. So these are aggregated aircraft residuals, aircraft data residuals, simulated minus observed. And then on slide 23, I show a figure from Sharon Gorgi's paper, which kind of looks at the impact of using two different boundary value estimates. One was an empirical boundary value estimate, and the other was from Carbon Tracker, which was probably Carbon Tracker 2009 at that point. And it basically makes the North American, the difference is big enough to make or break the North American CO2 net annual sink. It disappears using the empirical boundary value condition there for that particular time period. And those boundary values are only different by like half a ppm. And anybody who's done the math knows that even a couple tenths of a ppm can kill you when you're talking about the continental annual uptake signal. Okay. So the mechanics, looking at slide 25, we use this form of the inverse model equation. That's, again, from the Yadoff and Michalak paper. So I'm not going to go through it in detail. Many of you are familiar with inversions. So I'm just going to say what's in the box, that when you modify it to simultaneously optimize boundary values and fluxes, you need to add additional columns to the H matrix for the boundary value grid cells. I'll tell you how I'm gridding it in a minute. SP is the prior, and S hat, you also have to have a prior estimate of the boundary condition, and then you solve for it. And so the Q matrix, the prior error covariance, gets some additional rows and columns, but right now we haven't implemented any cross-correlation in the prior between boundary values and fluxes. In the posterior error covariance, you can have that emerge. So on slide 26, you can see that we have flux grid cells at 1 degree by 1 degree and 3 hourly resolution. And then the boundary value and initial condition grid cells are 2 degrees by 3 degrees corresponding to the global carbon tracker resolution and daily. And we specify error covariance length scales for each of these terms and error covariance time scales. And I have restricted the boundary value optimization region according to the land mask on the right-hand side in order to concentrate on the region where we have the most aircraft data. Defining slide 27 shows sort of an issue with defining boundary values. And so this is just a plot of a trajectory from the Wisconsin Tall Tower in the mid-afternoon. And so the values that are colored pink are potential values that you could choose for your trajectory endpoint. So basically, if you say after the air stops interacting with the surface and before it leaves our boundary value optimization region, you have something like 10 points that are circled magenta. You can see them in lat-long space on the left and in altitude versus longitude space on the right. So you can see that this particular trajectory exits the continental boundary layer via the free troposphere. So if you look at slide 28, that is the ensemble of trajectories for this particular observation, of which the previous one was one of the trajectories. And so all the points that are colored magenta are points that are within the boundary value estimation region, and they have permanently exited the continental surface layer. And so you can have endpoints that exit laterally via the marine boundary layer, vertically via the free troposphere, or they can still be in the continental boundary layer at the end of a 10-day run. And that's why when we do boundary value optimization, we optimize for a four-dimensional field and not a curtain or something. So we grid, when we create a boundary value footprint, we include all of these magenta points. We don't choose a single endpoint per trajectory. We include them all because it's arbitrary whether you choose the first time after it exits the continental boundary layer or the last one at the edge of the domain. And so we bin those points into three altitude levels shown on slide 29, and you can kind of see what the boundary value footprints look like. They're flow following, obviously. They're concentrated in the boundary layer. They're concentrated in along the coast. There's a few points that are within the continental boundary layer at the end of the run. And then what's called a transition region on the lower left, and that is like in the western U.S. where you have the mountains. That would be in the planetary boundary layer because this is all done in above sea level space, because that's convenient, whereas in the free troposphere up in the upper right, you see this big smooth field. And the units of these boundary value footprints are ppm per ppm. You change the boundary value by a ppm, you change the concentration by a ppm. People might have questions about that, but I kind of want to power through the next part, and then I'll pause for questions in a minute. So in the prior error covariance is another thing that we've monkeyed with. Yadav and Michalak use the model shown on slide 30 for their prior error covariance, which has a temporal covariance length scale, a spatial covariance length scale, and then a constant sigma, which is the diagonal elements of Q. It's constant throughout the whole spatial domain. You can vary the length scales and the sigma, like on the monthly time frame, but that paper does not describe a method for having a different uncertainty in the desert versus in the croplands. And so we have generalized that as shown on slide 31 to have a space-time varying sigma and to retain the off-diagonal elements being a Kronecker product of the space and the decaying space and length scales. And I'm not going to go into detail on that today. We're still testing it. We have a trick that allows us to avoid building any matrices that have the full dimension of Q, just like basically we exploit some patterns. If you do all the, I spent 3 days doing linear algebra, and basically just kind of found a way to exploit Vinit's tricks that are described in that paper, but just to extend them to allow the sigma to vary. And we have the code running, but I don't have any results yet. But that's going to be important because it's kind of obvious that you don't want to allow a lot of flux to get dumped in the desert when we don't think there are any plants there. So that's the big trick. I'm going to skip this part about the model data mismatch, except to say that we're trying to do a different model data mismatch value for each observation based on aspects of the model that you can look at that slide again later. Okay, so preliminary results. These are some figures that we made just showing slide 34, showing the sensitivity of in the summertime, July of 2010, the sensitivity of the surface network on the left, and that also includes some aircraft data, so all sort of quote-unquote in situ observations in the sense that in situ is used by the remote sensing community to include all flask and continuous measurements. And then on the right-hand side is the total sensitivity from the ACOS-GOSA observations. So you can see that in July of 2010, we got 2,623 GOSAT scenes that passed cloud clearing that were also within our domain. And the sensitivity to the surface fluxes in the GOSAT data is much less, orders of magnitude less, than the in-situ network. Now, people will have argued that the column data are less sensitive to transport errors. I don't completely subscribe to that argument, but it is a fact that the observations directly over North America are less sensitive to the surface than the in-situ network is to the surface. We might be able to increase the sensitivity for the column data if we extend the domain further to the east out over the Atlantic, because a lot of the East Coast fluxes will show up over the Atlantic. Slide 35 shows some results from a synthetic data inversion where we used, it's kind of a backwards inversion, but it was convenient to do it this way. So we used Carbon Tracker 2013 fluxes as the prior, and CASA GFED 3 fluxes that Jim Collette provided as the truth. And then on the lower left, we did an inversion with perfect synthetic in situ observations, perfect transport, no boundary value errors, and we're able to recover, you know, to a large extent, we're able to recover the truth. When we add the GOSAT data, we essentially get no change in the retrieve fluxes. And I haven't done the experiment where I only do the ACOS data but no in-situ data yet. This was done with a slightly older version of our inversion code, and it didn't have the spatially varying uncertainty yet. And so I'm in the process of trying to redo these now with a more developed code. On slide 36, you can see the difference between the prior simulated satellite observations, GOSAT observations, is the top, is the prior minus. So it's, these are all pseudo data, so it's observations simulated with the prior versus observations simulated with the truth. And so you can see that the posterior results agree better with the truth. So even though you can't see a big difference in the fluxes, we do see an improvement from the inversion in the agreement with the observations. That's probably being driven by the fact that we included so many in-situ observations. And then in slide 37, this is actually real ACOS data on the upper right compared with Carbon Tracker 2013 fluxes convolved with stilt footprints. And the Carbon Tracker 2013 fluxes, as I described earlier, well, I was showing you Carbon Tracker 2011, but it's generally similar. But there's still an excess of CO2 in the troposphere compared to the data in Carbon Tracker. So here I've taken Carbon Tracker fluxes and used convolved them with stilt wharf footprints for a forward simulation. That's the upper right. The lower left is the difference, and then the histogram is on the right. And there is, you know, some bias there. I think it's the opposite direction what I might have expected based on the in-situ observations. So this is just to demonstrate that we're, like, at the point where we can simulate the GOSAT observations. We can do inversions with and without satellite data. But we haven't – we're not at the point where we have, you know, publishable results yet. The next several slides are things that I showed at AGU last year, which describe how different kinds of errors, flux errors versus boundary value errors, manifest in the column and versus at different levels in the atmosphere if we had the ideal observation, which would be a profile all the way up into the upper troposphere. So these are just model calculations. They're like forward simulations. So the first one is just net ecosystem exchange, mean, July, midday, using the CASA Goddard DMS fluxes that Jim Collett provided. And they have a bigger, there's more uptake near the surface. And then we can look at the difference between the Carbon Tracker and the CASA fluxes. You can see the difference in map form on slide 39. This is of the fluxes themselves. And then on slide 40, you can see how that difference is manifested at the Park Falls site in the profile. And they look, you know, these profiles look pretty similar from CASA versus Carbon Tracker, but if you look at the axes, are actually different. So the CASA Goddard model has higher uptake. And then you can look at the column difference in map form on slide 41. So you can see that the differences between CASA and Carbon Tracker are up to maybe 2 ppm, according to the Stilt-Wharf model. And we can skip slide 42. That just also shows fire fluxes and fossil fluxes, and it shows some day-to-day variability as well as the monthly mean. And then slide 43 just shows the component fluxes in the column. Then slide 44 shows the hypothetical boundary value error that we imposed for some of our runs. And it's fairly consistent with Carbon Tracker's residuals, although not really truly consistent, but the magnitudes are similar. And so I think slide 45 is really interesting. It's the flux difference versus boundary perturbation, manifests in the profile. So you can see that the boundary perturbation that I imposed, but it's sort of what you would expect, is sort of uniformly distributed in the vertical, whereas the flux perturbation is concentrated near the surface. And so, you know, I would contend that the combination of surface data and column data should give us the power to separately resolve boundary value errors versus flux errors. So slide 46 shows a time series of column simulations at Park Falls using the two different biofluxes, and they look pretty darn similar in the time series. That is going to be hard to resolve with the precision that we think we have for even the TCON, let alone the satellite sensors. This is an idealized weighting function, not a real averaging kernel, but they're not that different. And then this slide 47 shows the time series difference between CASA and Carbon Tracker versus the time series difference of this boundary perturbation that varies slowly in time. And the magnitudes are similar. It could be very difficult to distinguish between these two different error sources if we only have column data. That's my contention. So just real quickly, our plans for 2014, we will extend this analysis to 2015. We will focus on trying to simulate OCO2 data. That's going to have too many observations for us to simulate each scene like we did for GOSET, so we're going to have to come up with a scheme for a long-track averaging, and we're testing that right now. Maybe we'll be able to increase the sensitivity to North America by extending the domain over the Atlantic, but we just kind of have to do some benchmarking to see what we can afford computationally and what the benefit is. And then we will be comparing our fluxes with those from the NASA CMS flux project, and we'll also be trying to investigate the consistency between in-situ and remote sensing data, both GOSAT, also TCON, and OCO2. And then I gave short shrift to the Amazonian part of this, but John Miller also had a previous CMS project, part of which was aimed at doing Lagrangian inversions for Amazonia, where our group, in collaboration with Luciana Gatti and Manuel Glor, have been able to do some new aircraft flights. And so there's paper that I have a screenshot of from on slide 50 is basically a mass balance carbon budget estimation. And so John will be leading an effort to do this in the Lagrangian framework. He's got some wind fields on the way already from Salo Freitas, who's from Brazil, using the BRAMS model. And then we're going to extend that to include Wharf Stilt. So we'll do some comparisons between Wharf Stilt and BRAMS Stilt. And we'll also be extending that to 2015. So, and slide 51 is just the punchline from that paper, which shows a big difference between the wet and dry years. So we're going to be seeing to what extent do we think the satellite can pick it up and that kind of thing. So that was a little bit long, but that is my last slide.
Thanks, Arlen. Yeah, that's really comprehensive. If I may jump
more than
in,
you wanted to know.
No, it's great. I'm not sure if it's a good reference too, and a good jumping off point for other discussions. But if I may just jump in with a question already, I wasn't sure exactly how you did the hypothetical boundary value perturbation on slide 44. Could you just explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So basically, whenever we do the inversions, so if we look back real quick at slide. There's a lot of slides.
I think it's number 44.
But if you look at slide 25 where you have the equation, Z in that equation is the observation minus background. So basically what I do to assign a background for the prior, I take all those endpoints locations that I showed on slide 28, and sample the model, the carbon tracker model, mole fraction fields, and then give each trajectory equal weight and come up with an average background value for the observation. And so when I do the boundary value perturbation, I just make the carbon tracker, I change the carbon tracker four-dimensional field according to slide 44, and I didn't put all the details on there, but it's I add a sum of exponential perturbations that are a function of time, latitude, longitude, and altitude. So I specify an amplitude, which you can kind of see from the plots is a few ppm. So basically saying if carbon tracker is wrong by 3 ppm over North America, and I don't allow my inversion to optimize for that, how wrong are the fluxes? That's what we're trying to do with that synthetic experiment. But I didn't show you any inversion results for that. I only showed you forward simulations of how big the impact is. Like, so how, if you have an error in the boundary condition, how big is the impact at your measurement location?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take some other questions.
I didn't hear everybody hang up, so hopefully there's still a few people online.
We're still here, but we're trying to take it in.
This is Ralph. I have a question about the boundary, too, in terms of the long-term vision. I had to duck out for 10 minutes there, so I'm sorry if I missed this. But, you know, it strikes me that the boundary problem is really, you know, how do you interface this with other studies that address fluxes on larger scales? And that's going to be a moving target.
Right.
I just wonder if the shelf life of this approach might not be rather short.
Well, I don't think the shelf life of my approach is short. I think you have to, unless you have perfect knowledge of the boundary condition from some four-dimensional model, and that is not imminent. Unless you have that, I don't see how you avoid optimizing the boundary values. I used carbon tracker as a prior, but I could have used a constant field as a prior. If you have enough aircraft observations that are primarily sensitive to the boundary, I think you can separate those.
So I was wondering whether OCO might have a big impact on this by providing information that maps onto the boundary.
Hopefully. I mean, having a robust surface network, robust is maybe not a very descriptive word or informative word, but having a lot of surface sites and having good column, unbiased column observations is almost as good as having profiles. But you have to have both, I would argue. So one thing, you know, the first time you tell somebody you're doing a regional inversion, almost everyone says, well, what are you going to do about the boundary values? And it's almost as if people in the global community don't recognize the fact that they also have boundary value problems. You know, I think we're coming to that realization with our Eulerian carbon tracker. The difference is, in a regional inversion, you actually have the ability to adjust the boundary values if you have enough data. Whereas in a global inversion, if you get the wrong fluxes over Asia, you are bound to have the wrong fluxes in North America, no matter how many data you have.
It may be good actually to use some of our time at the science team meeting to talk a bit more about the background as one of our topics. But maybe we could take any other questions on any other slides or.
I guess this is Ralph. I can ask another question. You know, the issue of how you deal with coastal fluxes comes up, and it mixes up with this boundary value question. If you allowed your land fluxes to spread over the oceans, would they?
Probably. They're prevented from doing so by the fact that we don't include any land, we don't include any ocean grid cells in this inversion right now.
Yeah, I just guess it might be worth learning a little bit about how sensitive that is.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, we do have ocean fluxes in the inversion to the extent that we take the carbon tracker ocean as the truth. We could take a different prior as the truth if we had a better one that was convenient and available for all the years. And we subtract that. We convolve the flux with the footprint and subtract that from the observation. But, yeah, that's just because it seems like it's convenient. So I guess the thing that I'm really excited about this whole project, you know, it's that we have made this huge library of footprints, and there are hundreds of ways to use them in inversions. And, I mean, I definitely hope that people will. I've seen that with the footprints we generated earlier for Anna's earlier NASA project. And so, you know, I certainly don't purport to have the last word right now. I think that some of the innovations we're making with the boundary value optimization and the spatially varying uncertainties will be important, but there's lots of room to develop this framework. And the footprints are species independent, so you can use them for methane wherever we have methane observations and for certain other greenhouse gases for which we have data. And also, like Heather, if you have sites, I should send my list to you of sites that I know about. I do talk to Mark Fisher and other people. But when we go forward, I want to make sure that if people in CMS are making in situ observations or other kinds of observations, we have the ability to include them in our receptor list.
Yeah, that's a good idea. We're going to have some column measurements, too.
Yeah, one thing I haven't done a good job of yet, you know, I've talked to you about it, Steve, is try to collect aircraft receptors from campaigns. So we're just kind of starting to reach out to people who have aircraft data to try to get a set of campaign obs packs built and to make receptor lists and go back and pick up some of those receptors that we missed, like COBRA or any of the HIPPO precursors.
Yeah, and Paul Shefson did a bunch of stuff with air moss. You have to know where to look. You wouldn't necessarily think of air moss.
Right. Yeah, no, that one I don't even know about. That's not on my radar at all. And then the P3 with the very good Chemical Sciences Division measurements of methane and CO2 made by Tom Ryerson and Jeff Peichel. but, yeah, we have – I mean, there's a lot of people out there. The NASA Langley Group makes good observations of CO2 and methane on the DC-8. So definitely if you know about data or you would like to have footprints, let us know and we will try to get them run.
Yeah, it really sounds like that sounds like a tremendous resource, and so it would be great to add any other sites that you don't already have.
Yeah.
And then would that be sort of filling in the time period that you already have, or it would be kind of going forward from here?
We can go backward. I expect that we will have to do at least one second pass through 2007 to 2012 to pick up some of these aircraft campaigns that we've missed and stuff. I'm sure there are a few errors in my receptor list, hopefully not too many. Tried to be careful, but Steve told me I might have the coordinates for one of the Earth Network sites wrong. So we're trying to, it's the beginning, but, you know, I think it could be a really powerful tool. And I really love the fact that you can do the component fluxes, you know, and look at them separately. That's something that you can't do easily in an Eulerian model unless you run a whole bunch of separate tracers. It's like, and even if you do, like, for we run ocean and bio separately through carbon tracker Eulerian, but we aren't able to tell you the difference between the last 10 days versus 100 days ago. You really have to have the adjoint information that the trajectories provide or to run the adjoint of the Eulerian model. and store it in a way that you can interpret. So I really think the footprints are pretty unique.
Hi, Arlen, this is Mark. I wonder, when do you think you'll be in a position to run footprints for 14 or 15?
Probably in about a year. 15 we may actually get to before 14, because 15 we have to do for the NASA CMS new project.
Very good. Thanks.
Yeah, so we'll be filling in 14, 13 as computational resources and funding allow. We do have a contract in place with AER to do 11 and 12. We have 11 and Doug Worthy's paying for 12.
So have you frozen the wharf?
No, we allow WARF to evolve. So we will do 2011 and 2012 with a slightly newer, better version than we did 2010. It's not, you know, it's not perfect. You have to choose between allowing it to get better or having a consistent version, and we've chose to allow it to get better. One thing that I'm worried about, and we've been talking about recently, is, like, you have all these WARF simulations for CARV, and hopefully that will go on for above. And, you know, I understand that some of the settings are rather different in the Arctic than what we may be using for North America as a whole. And kind of how to have, whether we can combine footprints from these different domains or come up with a configuration eventually that has different subdomains over the Arctic versus over the lower latitudes, I'm not sure what to do about that.
Yeah, it's not just the settings. The land physics model is different. I think Thomas could comment.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the domain configuration is different, and also some of the physics choices and underlying land surface ice fields and so on are, you know, done differently for the polar wharf computations than for the continental U.S.
I think snow is a big deal, and that can have some effects. It can introduce a lot of model data mismatch in the spring.
Yes, it's something I hope to achieve by working with all of you, you know, Mark Fisher in California and you, Steve, and AER with the CARV project, is to look at, you know, we can at least compare the footprints. We can do convolutions with the same set of fluxes and see how they look. I'm not exactly sure the best way to evaluate transport comparisons, but, you know, eventually we can run them all the way through an inversion and see how different the results are.
Yep.
It's definitely a process.
Yep, I have to ring off for class. That was really wonderful. Thanks.
(Clears throat)